I cried out. Drops of blood splattered on a rock in front of me.
Hurry up! There's snakes and skeletons down here!
A man's voice called down.
I'll warrant there'll be another one before spring. A little spindly one.
It was Tom Chaney. I had not yet made a good job of killing him. He was leaning over the edge and blood was falling from his wounded head. Then I heard a shout and the sounds of a scuffle and a dreadful crunch, which was Rooster Cogburn's rifle stock smashing into Tom Chaney's head. The light was blocked off and I made out a large object hurtling toward me. It was the body of Tom Chaney. He fell directly on the skeleton, crushing the bones and scattering the rattlesnakes. They were all about me.
Help! I need help!
Rooster's voice came booming down. I'm pitching down a rope.
I cannot manage a rope. Hurry up! There's snakes all about me.
Hold on, came another voice. It was LaBeef. The Texan had survived the blow. I watched as two rattlers struck and sunk their teeth into Tom Chaney's lifeless face. One of the smaller snakes approached my hand and rubbed his nose against it. I tried to move, but I felt a sting and saw an amber drop of venom on his mouth. He had bitten me. Now here came Rooster with a rope looped around his waist, descending in great violent leaps. He grasped me and heaved me up from the hole with one hand, at the same time kicking at the snakes. There were two dark red holes in his face where shotgun pellets had struck him.
Can you hold my neck? He said.
My arm is broken, and I'm bit on the hand.
With the same quiet clarity with which she had registered at Khalifi, I'm being swept out to sea, she grasped simply, oh, I lost my balance. For she was now executing the perfect backflip that she had never been able to pull off on a high dive. The air rushed in her ears like water. This time the feeling was different. That is, the starkness was there. The calmness was there also. But these clean, serene sensations were spiked with a sharp surprise, which quickly morphed to perplexity and then to sorrow. She fit in a wisp of disappointment before the fall was through. Her eyes tearing, the lights of high-rises blurred. Above, the evening sky rippled into the infinite ocean that had waited to greet her for 14 years. Largely good years, really. Gravy, a long and lucky reprieve. Then, of course, what had mattered was her body striking the plane, and now what mattered was not striking it. And what were the chances of that? By the time she reached the sidewalk, Liana had taken back her surprise. At some point, there was no almost. That had always been the message. There were bystanders, and they would get the message, too. The social, particularly to many scientists, but also many philosophers, was synonymous with the personal, the subjective, the irrational, the arbitrary, and even the coerced. If the conclusions of scientists, who for the most part were European or North American men, were social constructions, then they had no more or less purchase on truth than the conclusions of other social groups. At least a good deal of work in science studies seemed to imply that. But feminist philosophers of science, most notably Sandra Harding and Helen Longino, turned that argument on its head, suggesting that objectivity could be re-envisaged as a social accomplishment, something that is collectively achieved. Harding mobilized the concept of standpoint epistemology, the idea that how we view matters depends to a great extent on our social position, or colloquially, that where we stand depends on where we sit, to argue that greater diversity could make science stronger. Our personal experiences of wealth or poverty, privilege or disadvantage, maleness or femaleness, heteronormativity or queerness, disability or able-bodiedness, cannot but influence our perspectives on and interpretations of the world. Therefore, ceteris paribus, a more diverse group will bring to bear more perspectives on an issue than a less diverse one.